So one of the challenges of suicide is that these are internal experiences for most people when they're having suicidal thoughts or intentions about how they might want to die. And unless we ask someone, it can be very hard to access that information. And if there's someone in your life who you have concerns about, it really is important to ask. And a large body of research suggests that asking people about suicide doesn't increase their risk.
Welcome to Longevity by Design, a podcast designed to give individuals access to the leading scientific information in the field of longevity. The ability to add years to your life and life to your years needs no opinion. Join us as we ask science to take the wheel. In each episode, Dr. Gil Blander joins a co-host and an industry expert in the field of longevity, shining a light and getting the answers to the key question, how can we live a longer, healthier life?
Hello, I'm Dr. Gil Blander. Welcome to Longevity by Design, how to live a longer, healthier life. We are produced by InstaTracker, your science-based guide to optimizing your body from the inside out. Our guest today is Dr. Pete Frenz. We will discuss suicide prevention and mental health risk factor, digital mental health, and healthy equity. Dr. Frenz is an assistant professor at Yeshiva University with a secondary faculty appointment at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He earned his PhD in clinical physiology from Harvard University and completed his clinical internship at Columbia University Medical Center. At Yeshiva and Einstein, he teaches courses on statistics, research method, cognition, and emotion, and he is the director of the Risk Prediction and Prevention Laboratory. His research focuses on better understanding suicide and other self-injuries behavior, as well as developing accessible digital intervention for people at risk of suicide. Welcome, Pete.
Thank you so much. Really happy to be here. I'm glad to be able to talk about some of these important topics.
Thank you so much. And we always start with a question about what made you to become a scientist, and specifically, why have you decided to focus on this important topic?
Yeah, it's a great question. I will admit that I have been a curious type of person for all of my life. As a child, just interested in learning how things work. And as I got older, one of the things that I realized was that psychologists are unique among scientists, and that the things that we study, we are engaging with and doing all the time. We are being us. We are living our lives. And that's exactly what psychologists study. And a clinical psychologist, we also seek to try to understand how to optimize, how to improve people's well-being so that people can live the kinds of lives that are most meaningful to them and achieve the goals that they have. And so those are really the things that led me into psychology from a broad perspective. But within psychology, there's so many interesting, fascinating disciplines for people to focus on. And suicide stuck out to me for a couple of reasons. The biggest is that I've always been interested in helping people, and I think people who are at risk of suicide can be some of the most vulnerable people in society, the people who may need help the most. And in providing help to individuals who are at risk for suicide, the work may literally be saving lives. And I think that kind of call to action was something that has always motivated me and continues to motivate my work, the research being conducted in my lab, and by the graduate students who I supervise.
Thank you. And then now we'll start try to build a stage. So we'll start with what is the prevalence of a mental health issue in the US and in the world?
Yeah. So globally, the prevalence of mental health concerns are surprising. Here in the United States, for example, during a person's lifetime, about 50% of Americans will meet diagnostic criteria for some mental disorder, depression or anxiety, substance use disorder, et cetera. So about 50% or just under 50% will meet criteria for one of those. So it's a shockingly prevalent concern and one that we're working very hard to try and figure out.
Wow, that's astonishing. I haven't imagined. So basically one in two have a mental health issue. And I assume that most of us or most of the people that have it, it's undiagnosed, so it's going under the carpet in a way?
Yeah, so we think that's likely true, that, you know, yes, 50% of people who are walking around on the street right now may or may currently or at some point in their life have met criteria for a disorder, but the vast majority of those aren't known to mental health professionals and likely are not seeking help that they might benefit from.
Yeah. And what is the prevalence for suicide?
Yeah, suicide is particularly concerning in terms of its prevalence. So around 49,000 Americans died by suicide last year. And to put that kind of number into perspective, that's about double the capacity of our Madison Square Garden here in New York City, where I live. So that number is obviously concerning. But there's a considerably higher number of people who have attempted suicide, numbering over a million each year here in the United States, and countless more are thinking about suicide. So it's a tremendous concern from a public health perspective, and one that the CDC, for example, has generated a fairly broad call to action around, both in terms of increasing our research productivity around understanding suicide, as well as developing new interventions that will help people who are at risk.
So 1 million people attempted suicide in a year, but only around 50,000 succeed. So basically only 5% of the population that tried to suicide actually succeed. That's the statistic.
Yeah, that's probably about right. So it's about one, if I remember correctly, about one between 1.4 and 1.7 suicide attempts. But the difference in the way that we count suicide attempts versus the way we count suicide deaths is very different. Suicide deaths are often determined by a medical examiner or coroner when they are examining potential cause of death. Whereas for suicide attempts, sometimes those might be reported through statistics that occur in hospital settings, but they're also often self-reported. And so that could also be an underestimate in some ways.
Yeah. And as you know, we focus on longevity and health span. So what is the effect of mental health and suicide on health span and lifespan?
Well, it's tremendous. The reality is that because suicide is such a prevalent concern in the United States, it's in fact, across all age groups, the 10th leading cause of death for Americans. For individuals ages 14 to 44, it is the second leading cause of death. And so what that means is that suicide causes more death than homicide here in the United States, than for people 14 to 44, at least, than cancer, than heart disease or other physical ailments. It's second to accidents that occur in people's lives. And so, as I mentioned earlier, it's a tremendous public health concern. And we're really grappling with that in terms of ways to better understand when and where and why suicide might happen so that we can intervene. But in terms of the impact that suicide can have on a person's life, it's tremendous. Now, mental health concerns are obviously a risk factor for suicide, and mental health concerns broadly are something that reduce quality of life, that change the way that people interact socially, that change the way that people access the outdoors or seek medical care when they need it. And so there are really important ways that mental health concerns can impact people's health in ways that also impact longevity.
Yes, sounds like that. And I assume that COVID had even worsened the statistic on a suicide and mental health problem. Can you discuss that?
Well, so the data pretty clearly suggests that mental health concerns overall did increase since the start of COVID-19. Suicide, however, has been harder to pin down. During the early part of COVID, there was some data that suggested suicide actually reduced slightly, but then may have increased somewhat rapidly from 2021 to 2022. And maybe that was a delayed effect due to some of the concerns that were going on in COVID that I'm happy to talk about. But there's no doubt that COVID, from a psychological perspective, was incredibly challenging for people here in the United States and around the world. And I think one of the biggest reasons was because it fundamentally changed the social landscape of our lives. We are no longer attending work in person. We're doing work by Zoom. We are no longer going to doctor's visits in person. We're often doing those via telehealth or some similar digital means. And so it's really changed the way that we interact with others and may also have led to people feeling incredibly isolated, which is a vulnerability factor for mental health concerns across the board. And suicide.
Yeah, so if we are trying to think about intervention, it sounds like what I'm hearing from you is try to go more to work, try to go to your physician meeting, try to go and buy the grocery at the supermarket, and don't use Instacart because we need this interaction, and living on Zoom is not enough. That's a fair statement.
What I would say is that I think it's really important for people to be able to have opportunities for interactions with others. And there are lots of benefits that many of us have had during COVID-19 in terms of the transition from in-person activities to Zoom-based activities, for example. It gives you more flexibility with your time, shorter commutes, et cetera. And so I wouldn't say across the board that we should avoid these kind of things. What I think is important is that if we're doing a lot of our activities through digital means like Zoom, that we find other ways to make sure that we're connecting with people in real life, but also potentially through these digital channels as well. The idea is we want to make sure that people have a supportive and close social network. And there's actually lots of ways that we can do that, even including the internet.
Okay, excellent. That's a great suggestion. And are there a particular demographic groups that are more prone for a mental health issue and suicide?
Well, yeah, there's a few demographic statistics in terms of suicide risk. One of the most important ones is that men are about overall 4 times more likely to die by suicide than women, whereas women are actually more likely to attempt or to think about suicide than men.
And that's funny in a way. Why is it? Why men are better in killing themselves? Or what's happening here?
So what we think might be going on is probably a multitude of factors that we haven't been fully able to understand. If we knew exactly what was happening, we'd be able to do something better to prevent suicide death in general, but also among men. But one of the statistics that I think is the most striking that is likely leading to this difference, at least in some part, is that men die by suicide more often than women using firearms. In fact, across the world, men are about 6 times more likely to die by suicide using a firearm than women.
Okay. And if we are talking about firearm, in the US, it's much easier to get a firearm, let's say, than Europe. So you see more suicide in the US or successful suicide because it's easier for us to get those pistols?
So in that sense, what's happening here is that, yes, suicide by firearm is more common among men, but it doesn't account for differences necessarily between countries in terms of overall suicide rate. What we have in the United States is some suggestion that there are more suicides by firearm proportionately to other countries. But in other places around the world, we see more prevalent suicide means, so ways that people take their own lives using other methods. So for example, in countries that have high agricultural output, there tend to be greater use of pesticides or fertilizers as a means of suicide. So what we think that represents is maybe something about access to lethal means. What people have that's available to them, they'll use. And that may be accounting for why we see not necessarily so much different rates of suicide, but different methods of attempting suicide across countries.
What about the location that you live? Like if you are living closer to the North or the South Pole, you have a better chance to attempt suicide because of the longer nights, or you don't see an association like that?
Yeah, so I'm not aware of that specific association, but there is a geographic association, which is that people who live in more rural areas are at greater risk for suicide than people who live in more urban areas. And we can think about ways that social isolation might be playing a particularly important role, as well as things like access to mental health care. Social isolation and access to mental health care, social isolation is more common and access to mental health care is lower in places that are more rural, to have fewer people living in them.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, unfortunately, they have less access and they cannot use the services that they can. But maybe now with the digital solution, they might have a better access. So that might be a good news for them.
That's my hope. And one of the main drivers of a large portion of my research program.
What about a different age bracket? You already described that in younger age, suicide is higher, but that makes sense because a lot of the aging related diseases starting to kick up later. But if you look at a specific age range, are there a specific age range that have a higher percentage of suicide than other age ranges?
Yes, quite clearly. So age 65 and above is the highest risk age group. And in particular, men ages 65 and above, they account for a disproportionate number of suicides.
And is there a correlation between marital status, or meaning someone that is have a spouse, I assume, but I mean, might be wrong, less chance than someone that is a single or divorced or a widow?
Not aware of a statistic that points in one direction or the other, but we know is that social support, or lack thereof, and feelings of social isolation is a risk factor, at least for suicidal thoughts and suicide attempts. And so it stands to be reasoned that having close others in your life, whether it's through a marital relationship or any other type of familial relationship, or even friendships or professional relationships, those are protective.
Yeah. And what are the major reasons that people commit suicide?
Well, it's really hard for us to know exactly. One of the reasons is that each person who attempts suicide may be doing so for entirely different reasons. So if you have 10 people who've all attempted suicide, you might have 10 separate reasons. To make that even more complicated, there is likely not a single reason that each person who dies by suicide or attempts suicide does so. So it's a really complex equation of many inputs leading to a similar output. And that's one of the reasons why it's been so hard for us to get traction on this. Nevertheless, we do know something, generally speaking, about various risk factors. So having multiple mental health disorders is a risk factor. Social isolation, as I mentioned, is a risk factor. But the strongest risk factors for suicide are actually prior suicidal thoughts and behavior. So if you've thought about or attempted suicide in the past, that seems to be associated with a dramatic increase in risk of future suicide attempts.
Okay. So if I have a friend that I suspect that he or she has a suicidal thought, what should I look at?
You should ask that person. So one of the challenges with suicide is that these are internal experiences for most people when they're having suicidal thoughts or intentions about how they might want to die. And unless we ask someone, it can be very hard to access that information. And if there's someone in your life who you have concerns about, it really is important to ask. And a large body of research suggests that asking people about suicide doesn't increase their risk.
As a Longevity by Design podcast listener, you understand the value of improving your health for today and for all the years ahead. And if you want to live your healthiest, longest life possible, you need to understand what's going on inside. At Inside Tracker, we take a personalized approach to health span optimization that eliminates guesswork from your wellness plan. Inside Tracker analyzes blood biomarker and DNA data, along with physiomarker data from fitness trackers like Oura Ring, to deliver personalized food, supplement, lifestyle, and exercise recommendations that allow you to take control and improve your health span. And for a limited time, Longevity by Design listeners can get 20% off at the Inside Tracker store. So if you're ready to receive a personal health analysis and data-driven wellness plan to optimize your body for the long haul, then it's time to start inside. Visit insidetracker.com/podcast to get started today. That's insidetracker.com/podcast to get started today.
So basically, point blank, to come to this person and say, are you considering to commit suicide, or there is a better way to do it?
I would suggest using maybe a little bit more warmth than that. I think one of the things that's really tricky about suicide is that it is stigmatized. I think all mental health concerns are stigmatized in different ways, but suicide is particularly stigmatized. And that makes it very hard for people to talk about it, to seek help, to acknowledge that they might be struggling with something because they fear how others will react. And so as someone who cares about another person who we suspect may be at risk for suicide, entering that kind of conversation in a warm, supportive, and empathic way could be really important for helping to demonstrate that if you're asking about something that's sensitive, like suicide, it's because you really care and what you want to do is to help and not to be judgmental or to push them away.
And what is the point that you should try to involve a professional like yourself? What is the point that if you see someone that you feel that is might be, when should you go to professional and ask them for the support?
Well, it depends on whether we're talking about the person who is at risk or someone close to that person. So if the individual who is at risk, if they are experiencing suicidal thoughts or some other indicator that suicide could be something that's a problem or concern for them, that is the time for them to go seek mental health care. There are lots of treatments available for individuals, and there are lots of treatments that can meet the needs of a specific individual. They range from talk therapy to medications and many things in between that can really target in very specific ways an individual's unique needs. So when people are at risk for suicide, I always recommend finding ways to reach out to a mental health professional for support.
What about the person that is in a relationship with this person that suspect that this person might have mental issues that can lead to commit suicide? What should he or her do?
So in the course of a supportive and warm conversation where you're expressing understanding that a person is experiencing challenges and that you really want to help, I think it's an okay thing to suggest that maybe there's a way to find mental health support and even to offer assistance with that process to make the person feel like they're not alone, that you're not telling them what to do, but instead that you're willing to help begin that journey with them, at least to the point where they're able to then begin some sort of regular mental health care.
Okay, so try to basically to convince him or her to go and take a support from a professional. It won't work very well to call to a professional and say, hey, you should talk with this person. That's fair to say?
That's fair to say. I think better to help the individual feel some internal motivation, some agency around the process so that they can reach out and schedule an appointment and start working with someone toward the goal of feeling better.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I have a personal situation similar to that. I have a relative of mine that she's in the mid-80s, I would say, and she lost her husband. And now she got into depression. So basically she gave up all her life. She doesn't have any physical issue, but she have, I assume, a mental issue. And she's not trying to fight and continue to live and enjoy her life. What would you do in that situation? What is the best way? How can we convince her to try to fight and be better?
If it were a close person in my life who was experiencing that, my first step would be to reach out to them, to try and offer support, to try and be with them, to try and help them build some time into their schedule when they can be with other people, including myself. I think offering social support really helps do two things. Number one, it helps people feel less alone. But number two, it can likely also help people to feel like they could reach out to someone for support, like a professional, if they felt like they were ready to do that. So having these kinds of conversations, helping people to feel supported, I think goes a long way in terms of improving potential outcomes.
Thank you for that. That's a good suggestion. And as you said, somehow a population above the age of 65 have more mental health issues. So I assume that it's prevalence. And again, it's very relevant for our podcast about longevity, that it's not enough to have a fit body. You need also to have a fit brain and mind. And if you don't have that, so for what to have a fit body if your health, mental health and brain is not functioning? So it's a very good point.
That's right. Though I think it's really important to mention that these things are linked. Our psychological well-being is linked to our physical well-being. Getting out and being active, staying physically fit is a component of mental health care. And having practices that improve your mental health care can also promote physical health care, doing things like exercise or attending regular doctor's visits. So I think these things are linked and we can promote them in very similar ways.
So what other, you mentioned that the intervention like exercise can improve mental health, and I agree with you 100%. I can see it in the days that I feel a bit blue, I'm going for a cycle and I come back very energetic. What other interventions like nutrition, like what is the effect of sleep? What is the effect of other interventions that can improve someone that feel normal. And we started by saying that half of us have some mental health issue. We don't know about that. But if you look at yourself, you have 50% chance to have a mental health issue. That's what I'm heard from you, Pete.
So yeah, at some point in your life, that's right.
Yeah. So how can we prevent it? So you said exercise. What else can we do in order to reduce the chance that we'll get into such a situation?
Yeah, you named the two really big ones from a physical health perspective. Number one, sleep. So sleep challenges are associated with a range of mental health concerns and suicide. So getting regular sleep, having scheduled sleep, finding ways to ensure that you're sleeping as well as you can through the night, and all that we know about sleep health is a really important factor for improving mental health. Interestingly, diet is also becoming an increasing focus of psychologists. The link between what we put in our bodies and how our minds are functioning is growing continually clearer. And so there's recommendations about providing for our mental health by eating healthy foods as well.
Yeah, that's good. What about other intervention or other risk factor that can make you more likely to have a mental health issue, like, for example, substance abuse or other?
Yeah, there's a few really big ones. If we're thinking about mental health concerns across the board, one of the big ones is traumatic life events. So, of course, having something really horrible happen in your life, the threat of death or experiencing something violent or something terrible happening to someone you care about can be part of post-traumatic stress disorder. So people might begin to experience traumatic stress reactions to having something really horrible happen to them. But those kinds of events can also lead to other mental health conditions, different types of anxiety disorders or depression, for example, or even schizophrenia can result from having an extraordinarily stressful life condition for individuals who have some kind of biological predisposition for such a disorder. Okay. So stressful life events are across the board a major predictor of mental health concerns.
Yeah. Is a genetic is a factor? Let's assume that if my father or my mother had a mental health issue, I have a better chance to have it as well, or no relationship?
Yes. So there are some disorders that show a stronger genetic component than others. So schizophrenia is a big one. Bipolar disorder is another. Other disorders, it's been harder to nail that down. That a lot of the variation that we see in terms of anxiety, for example, can be due to a multitude of other factors. And so it's been harder to isolate specific genes that are leading to disorders like anxiety.
Yeah.
One thing I'll say on anxiety, though, as long as I brought it up, is that there are studies that show that anxiety, for example, does tend to run in families. So if you have a parent who has anxiety, you're more likely than someone who doesn't have a parent with anxiety to experience some concerns related to anxiety. But that may be about shared environment, that you grew up learning from your parent who interacted with the world in an anxiety-provoking way, for example. So it doesn't necessarily seem to be related to genes in a particularly strong way, even though they may be playing some part.
Okay. And let's assume that someone tried all the exercise and nutrition and sleep and they failed, and he went to a professional and started to have a session with this professional. What should this person expect? What happened in those sessions?
That's a great question. So this is one of the things that I think can function as a barrier to prevent people from going to a mental health care professional, because they don't know what to expect. They don't know what it's going to be like. They know what conversations are going to be like. They don't know how hard it's going to be for them as the individual sitting and talking about their personal information. So mental health care works fairly similarly, regardless of the type of, there are some similarities at least, regardless of the type of mental health care professional you're seeing. Often you'll do some sort of intake appointment where the mental health care professional will learn things about you. They'll want to find out about your history, your family history, how long you've been experiencing concerns, what types of concerns are going on for you. I often, with individuals I work with clinically, talk a lot about what are the things that you do that you enjoy and that improve your mental health. And then therapists will take that information and start to craft a treatment plan, often in direct collaboration with you as the patient or client, to come up with a way that we're going to approach what's going on, to start to understand it better, and to start to find ways of remediating the challenges that you're experiencing. But I think it's important for people to recognize how collaborative mental health care can be. Rather than the professional sitting in a room and telling you what to do and to think, it's often much more about how can we do this together? How can we identify the goals that are important to you and find ways to work toward those?
Yeah, so it's more like trying to understand you and finding what drove you to this direction and how can we take you out of this path and move you to a better path. And there are infinite way of different paths. So it's not like the path that Pete would like to go. It's more like, Gil, where do you want to go? And let's try to work together. How can you go there? That's fair to say?
Sure. That's fair to say.
Yeah. And I know that a lot of healthcare system right now provide coverage for that. And I'm not sure that a lot of people know that. So it's something that is most likely covered by health insurance. And it's like, in a way, it's like a disease. It's not like nobody should blame himself that he have those issues. It's most likely a medical issue that you can solve via a professional. So I don't see any shame with that, that you went to a professional and worked on that and made it better.
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful perspective, especially if it helps people to feel like mental health care is more available to them and there are fewer barriers in their way of accessing it if they need it. So yeah. I totally agree. One of the really big challenges we face, though, given the prevalence of mental health concerns, is that it can be hard to find a provider depending on where you live. I'm here in New York City. There are two psychologists who have practices on this block, but that is an incredibly unique geographic phenomenon. If you go somewhere else, like where I grew up in upstate New York, a very rural part of the same state, there might be no mental health care professionals in your town. And so figuring out resources can be super important. A place to ask often is at your primary care physician. They will often have a list of participating mental health care providers who will take your insurance available. And so you can always ask a primary care physician for a referral.
And how would the patient know when to stop? When is, okay, I cured for that, or you never cured and you need to continue to do that?
It's a different answer for every person. And there are many people who enjoy therapy and it helps them with lots of aspects of their daily life and will continue it for a long time. There are others who have very specific concerns and a very time-limited treatment can provide them with tremendous relief such that they cease treatment after they feel like they have made the improvements they were looking for. So it really varies on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, and I see it in the more relatively young generation. I see that they are much more open for that. I think that in my generation, they are more against that in a way. It's like a taboo. And it's similar in a way to, I'm looking at, again, at longevity holistically, and I see that it's very hard to see in the gym women above the age of 50 that lifting weight, because it was a taboo. No, women shouldn't lift weight. And that's really wrong, because a postmenopausal woman losing a lot of muscle, and for them it's very important, actually. But somehow they don't do it. They prefer to go on the treadmill. So I think it's the same here for the relatively older population. I would say that it's a way, I shouldn't go there. I'm okay. And let's say grab it under the carpet. Do you agree with this observation?
I agree with the observation. So I do think there's been a tremendous shift in public discussion about suicide, about mental health, certainly in the United States, but I think outside the United States too. We have celebrities who will talk about struggles with mental health and how they've sought treatment and that's improved their lives. I think that provides a really important model for people who might be struggling with mental health concerns. Number one, I think it helps to reduce stigma. By having these public conversations, we start to recognize that it's a lot more common than we realize that people all around us might be struggling and that it can be talked about. This is something that someone can discuss on a news station with news anchors, and the news anchor is reacting in a totally supportive and empathic way. I think that is a signal that can really help people. But the other thing that happens in this context is when people are talking about their own mental health struggles, the steps they've taken to improve those, such as seeking treatment. I think that that destigmatizes the seeking of treatment for people who are struggling with mental health concerns and removes a tremendous barrier. So I think that you're right. There are generational differences here. And I'm really proud of the way that people from the younger generation, even younger than I am, have really embraced mental health as a societal concern and reduced the shame that might be associated with talking about it.
Yeah. And it's, again, looking at the angle of longevity, why should you work so hard to exercise and to eat well if you have an issue with your mental health? And also, it's very hard to do it if you have an issue with mental health, because then you basically give up on your life, or worse than that, you commit suicide. So I think that everyone that wants to live better, longer, I think that it's a must. It's a given that you need to have a good mental health. And if you need to talk with a professional, so do it. It's great. It's another tool that you have in your toolbox, and you should use it.
Yeah, I agree. I don't want to, you know, I want to be clear that I do think people experience really serious challenges with this, but I want them to hear from us that it's a really common thing for people to experience mental health challenges, and there is someone out there who not only is capable of helping you, but could do so in a way that really works for you. And I think that if more people had that realization, it might reduce some of the barriers they experience to seeking help.
Yeah. And going back to a suicide, so someone that commits suicide have a better chance to commit suicide again, or it's like always depend on the treatment, and if you got a good treatment, you might not do it again?
Well, that's probably true. So prior suicide attempt is the number one predictor of future suicide attempt. But it's true that for individuals who seek treatment and experience improvements in their mental health, including their potential suicidal thoughts, that those individuals will experience a reduced risk for suicide.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's good to know. So, Pete, anything else that our audience should know about mental health and suicide that we haven't had the chance to discuss yet?
We've covered a lot of bases, and I really appreciated the conversation. There's nothing else on my list unless you have more questions, because I'm, of course, happy to answer them.
Yeah. So I have the last question that we ask in every episode is about what is your tip for a healthy, longer life? What would you recommend our audience to do in order to live better, longer?
Take care of yourself. Listen to what your mind and body are telling you about yourself. And so when you feel like you might be needing it, to look for help from a mental health professional, from a medical professional, from a friend. I think that it's really important that we're all looking after ourselves and identifying when it might be time for us to look for support from other people. We are a social species after all, and we're built to provide support. And so looking to others, I think, for that kind of support is something that we can all do, and that would improve our life in tremendous ways.
Excellent. That was a fascinating episode for me. As someone that is not an expert in this domain, I learned a lot, and I really appreciate your time and wisdom, and thank you so much again.
My absolute pleasure. It's great to meet you. I think this is a great thing that you're doing and talking about mental health, and so I thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Longevity by Design. Please subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Longevity by Design is powered by Inside Tracker, a personalized health optimization platform that helps people improve their lives by improving their bodies from the inside out using personalized, science-backed recommendations for nutrition, supplements, and lifestyle changes. To learn more, visit insidetracker.com/podcasts.